Blog Talk Radio.
Now, PW Torch brings you the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show. It's time to talk this week's WWE Monday Night Raw.
Well, Tom, we could start a few places on this episode of Raw, but I'll just start with the main event. How do you think Dominic Mysterio did in roughly 15-minute main event match against Edge in all the categories that count? Wrestling skill, timing, realism, body language, emoting. This was a big moment for somebody who, you know, not to conflate two segments, but, you know, Kevin Owens in theory talked about somebody getting a leg up because of how they look. Well, Dominic, if in like a real life sense, is getting a bit of a leapfrog over a lot of people who went through developmental because of his dad. And so it's a storyline, but it's also a reality. Did he look like he earned that spot tonight?
And it's, to be fair, it's been a relatively long journey for Dom to get to this significant main event spot. And I think my overarching concern, maybe, I don't know if concern is really the word, but my what I'm coming away with is the question, have we just seen the highest height that Dominic will rise to as an active wrestler? And I think that's going to remain on my mind, you know, regarding this whole subject, because the story is there for him. But I will say that as someone who has historically not been really on board the Dominic train, not, I wouldn't say a detractor, but he doesn't excite me all that much, and the things he's involved with have not engaged me very much. The storytelling in this match was very interesting, and I would say the brunt of it was on Edge's shoulders, but they were dealing with a complex setup here where Dominic was the sympathetic figure, but he's also the twerpy heel, and Edge is the more vicious guy trying to teach the lesson, but he's still very, very much in the babyface role with, you know, one of the people who Dom turned on in Ray still like begging Edge not to do what Edge feels, what Edge doesn't want to do, but what he feels he needs to do. And of course, that's what commentary was telling us what was going on, but I felt Edge was doing a good job of making that seem like that was where he was coming from as well. But for Dom's part, and you know, I'm someone who feels that the storytelling element in wrestling is far more important than the physical work. Dom really lived up to the side of it that he needed to. I was engaged and just really trying to figure out where they were going just tonight, where they're going in the long term of this storyline, and the fact that, you know, someone in our position, someone in my position as a guest analyst on PW Torch and whatnot, is sitting there not having a finite idea of where this is going, but still being interested, I think that says a lot. And, you know, Dom was there as a large part of the match, and his entrance, you know, sure, they gave him the new music and the lights and the new outfit and everything, so there's the aesthetics of it, but his demeanor still, I think, lived up to the moment and had me intrigued, you know, to see what he was going to do. And then for the working part of it, you know, I was bought in for the storyline. So nothing he did physically took me out of that. So that was a crucial element here, I think.
Yeah, I mean, if Dominic wanted to have the third worst match on Raw, he succeeded. And I don't mean that in a negative sense for him. As much as, like, you know, people who believe that he's getting pushed above his skill level and experience. And like you said, it's been a long journey, but this is still he didn't go through developmental. He didn't have main event matches where you're like, oh, on NXT, where people are like, oh, this guy can be something on the main roster. This was still a big test for him in a brand new role. And yes, he's against Edge, who's, you know, a pro and going to be able to have a good match with just about anyone. But I mean, I would say that there were a couple of matches worse than this happened to be the women's matches on this show. And even on its own merits, even if there weren't a couple rough matches earlier, I thought he looked good. You know, I mean, I think he's playing the part he needs to play. And I don't resent him getting a leg up because of who his dad is, in part because it's integral in his story. You know, they're baking into his, it's baked in, but not highlighted. Does he belong here? You know, they don't dwell on that. Like, is he getting an advantage because of who his dad is? But it is sort of baked in. You know, people sort of feel that way about him. But he's been, you know, a largely likable, sympathetic character who seemed a little over his head, but getting coached by his dad. So everything in real life that you might use to second guess Dominic on Raw is acknowledged at least in how he's pushed. And I'll contrast it with, you know, 30 years ago, Bill Watts pushing Eric Watts. And, you know, there are just these embarrassing videos gushing about what a great athlete and how charismatic and how sexy Eric Watts was. It was just uncomfortable to watch sometimes. And that's not what they're not treating Dominic like he's a top star. And so the idea now is, hey, he broke away from his dad to try to grow and prove himself. And you also have the, you know, Rhea Ripley playing her part really well on the sidelines. And that chemistry and that dynamic, and the announcer saying, you know, that he always had this resentment in him, and now it's being brought to the forefront by the Judgment Day. So I just think there's enough storyline support to blunt some of the criticism, because everything about his story sort of matches the reality. And I would say tonight, and I would even say last week, but as a character with his facial expressions and his body language, that produced video package, and then what he did in the ring tonight, I think he gets a passing grade. You know, I don't think anyone's going, this is the next great wrestler of this generation. You can't rule anything out, but I mean, he's nowhere near anyone being able to declare that. But I think he's, first, the storytelling, as you put it, that WWE is putting him in a position, an important position and an important role in a story. I think he's carrying it out, body language, facial expressions, promos, and in terms of his work in the ring, and, you know, it's a compliment to Edge, too. But I think Dominic has looked sufficient otherwise also. So I wasn't surprised. He looked, real solid here in the main event.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. And, you know, while none of us like when nepotism affects us in the real world, well, you know, you know what I mean. When it comes to wrestling, we see a lot of it, and especially covering NXT, like everybody, it seems like half of the roster at any given time is somebody's offspring. but you know, the storyline is so interesting here that, you know, you step back and you realize, like, well, I'm on board for the ride, and you know what, they couldn't be telling this story with anyone other than Rey's real son. So, you know, like if they had done this with Kurt Angle and Jason Jordan, like I don't, it wouldn't have the same effect.
Right.
And just for that part of it, which is slightly tangential, but you know, Rey coming at it, it could be such a simpler story where Rey agrees with Edge and they want to teach a lesson to Dom and the Judgment Day, and then it's just heels versus babyfaces like usual. But Rey still playing the father and still wanting to defend his son even when his son has turned on him, I think I'll use the term lightly, but I do think it lends more of an air of reality to it. Actually, a better word is believability. I believe it more. And it's just, again, it's just so much more of an interesting situation. So much of this match was, we're on Edge's side here, but there are the wrinkles of Dom being sympathetic. And so we're starting to wonder, with the vicious look in Edge's face, and Edge, I loved the touch that Edge kept on pausing to look at the crowd. Like, hey, you guys still with me? Mm-hmm. Was the impression I got from that. Like, you know, you're not turning on, I'm not going too far. Right. But then the question that is in all of our minds throughout this match is, how far is too far, though? I was also wondering when the cheap shot was going to come in and Dom was really going to take over. That never really came.
I would say Rhea Ripley grabbing his leg on a superplex attempt the interference that explained Dominic getting a leg up, no pun intended, on Edge.
Right. And you were right about your comment on Rhea. She, her facial expressions on the outside helped tell the story very well. But yeah, we're wondering how far is too far. And of course, when Dom gets tied up in the ropes, like Andre.
You mean on TV,
like, okay,
not with Rhea behind the scenes.
Exactly.
Sorry, but they're implying so much, and I know it's gone crazy on social media, and I couldn't let that go. I had to strike in the moment. I mean, the idea that
he's turning
him into a man, it's like it's 10-year-old friendly, because it's all, you know, it's suggestive, but in a way where no one, you know, young would connect the dots. But for adults, they're like, I know what's going on. You know, I know what's going on with her. So anyway, you can finish your point if you can.
Oh, yeah. You know, you're just thinking as the viewer, like, oh, well, this is when Ray's got to come in, right? And of course he did. And thankfully, for the sake of awkwardness, that it wasn't the other situation that you're talking about that Ray walked in on.
Yes. I was going to say about the finish. I was pretty negative and pretty forceful in my criticism last Friday of having the cop-out finish that they had for Solo Sikoa and Drew McIntyre with Karrion Kross coming in and the special effects and all and you know all that. In part because I was still kind of worked up about how disrespectful towards matches WWE was on Raw earlier in the week when the Tag Team Contendership match was just tossed aside by Braun Strowman, just decimating four tag team acts, including a future single star, presumably in Montez Ford. And it wasn't like a big deal. It was all about Braun as opposed to, hey, there was a match and it was being fought for quite a while and it had high stakes. And now because Braun came back, that trumps everything. That's a bigger deal than everything. And so I still had that chip on my shoulder a little bit going into SmackDown, and then to end the show with this highly anticipated match and just a cop-out escape hatch finish at Karrion Kross. I know it fits storyline-wise. Not the worst thing WWE's ever done, but I was worried it was the start of a pattern with Paul Levesque to not, because it's so easy as a booker to look at a dilemma and go, oh, I don't think this guy can win without it hurting that guy. But if that guy wins, I don't think it's the time is right for that moment. Then you could apply that to Drew. You know, I don't want Drew to lose again, but it's not the right time for Solo Sikoa to lose either because it's his first match. So we'll just have Karrion Kross interfere. You can talk yourself into that as a booker all the time. And there's occasions where it's really the smart thing to do. And maybe Friday is one of those times if you aren't in a pattern of doing it. And so tonight we had a non-finish again with Ray running in. This I had a lot less of an issue with. However, it's still three shows in a row where there's like this match with some stakes. I mean, you can argue about how many people cared about the tag team title, but that's a self-perpetuating issue, which is sort of illustrating my point. You know, people aren't worked up about the fact that Braun ended a tag match prematurely because everyone's so used to it. And that's my argument, is people are getting used to something that's causing them to be less invested in match outcomes. This is an example of where I think you save it. So this is a rare occasion where you do it, because it didn't feel like it was a cop-out finish. It felt very natural that that's what Ray would do. And it fit the story they told during the show of Ray being reluctant to, you know, try to get Edge to not do what he was going to do to Dominic. So to me, this is one of those exceptions that sort of is illustrative of why you want to save your sort of non-finishes for when it makes a lot of storyline sense. As Saxon said, it wasn't so much about beating Edge as it was teaching him a lesson, whatever the story was, whatever the phrase was. So how are you just in terms of specifically tonight and this finish and my defense of it, but with the asterisk that it is now three shows in a row that Paul Levesque has had a match of significance where there was a bit of a cop-out finish?
I was definitely thinking in the moment, wow, this would play a lot better if they hadn't copped out on Friday. And as someone who usually looks at big DQ finishes in a nutshell and sees the reasoning behind them, even when there's a pattern, I agreed with everything that you said on Friday's show with Kelly about in your opening rant about that DQ finish, especially coming out after exactly what you said with Braun. And the thing with Braun that upset me so much was that it didn't matter that it happened there. He could have come out at any point in the show and it would have been the same, like, oh, Braun's back and he's beating people up. It didn't matter that it was there. The only significance
he could have attacked Street Profits from behind after their win, for instance. And then also went after, you know, the other teams when they were beaten up after a grueling match. You know, they could have had a match finish and protected Montez by having the attack be from behind or when Montez was coming to defend a couple others in the match. Sorry for interrupting, but like you brought up like how easy it would have been to kind of meet halfway on that and still have Braun have the impact he had, but not just discard the match like it meant nothing.
Yeah, it really felt like the only reason Braun came out there is because Raquel Rodriguez was in, I believe it was the next segment, and something that we've already seen on Raw with things like Tommaso Ciampa going backstage right before Johnny Gargano comes out to return on Raw, or you know, on NXT time and time again, where things would happen like Mia Yim would be finishing up her segment and Keith Lee would be coming out to do his. Part of me is like, oh, it's just a nice thing that Triple H does. He observes the people who care about one another, and he wants them to have that little moment between their segments backstage. But maybe there's more to it that he feels it enhances their segment, that just a good morale thing to see a loved face of encouragement on your way through the curtain. But it is a pattern that he shows, and I don't think we saw that tonight specifically, but it felt like, is that the only reason why that's the segment Braun interrupted? Because on the format, Raquel was next, so they were like, all right, let's have them cross paths backstage. But that is something that I've noticed about Levesque's formatting, if not booking, at least formatting of the show. Yes, tonight, I thought that what we were going to get as the complexion of the match was unfolding, I thought what we were going to get was an Edge who had just completely laid out Dominic. Dominic is just totally helpless. Rhea's got her hands on her head on the outside. Maybe she's tried to interfere, but Edge overcame it. And Edge is pinning Dom, but he's starting to realize that he's maybe gone too far. So we do get a finish, and it is dramatic, and you're sort of wondering, well, how's Rey going to respond to this? But they wanted to get that compelling moment with Rey coming out and standing up to Edge while Dom was helpless. And I've, you know, in the like few minutes between the show going off the air and our show going on the Torch airwaves, I was rolling through my head all these different scenarios, and I personally couldn't come up with one in that short period of time that gives you that really good Rey moment while also giving you a finish. So I do agree that this is an instance where you do want the DQ finish, but it is unfortunately coming in as part of a running pattern here.
And if your belief is, hey, it's WWE and people aren't invested in finishes, they just want drama and stories being forwarded, and you should save top stars losing clean or somewhat tainted for when it really counts, you pay a price for it. You know, and that is people disinvesting in matches where they sort of see there's not likely a finish coming here. And I don't think people wanted to see that, you know, tonight in the Broncos-Seahawks game. You know, like, wow, we can't have either of those teams lose. Look at the depth. Look at the story going on here with the rivalry and the history of some of the players, and there's so many things going on. We can't have one of those teams lose to the other. That would hurt the losing team too much. You know, the Vikings beat the Packers, and that doesn't mean that they can't, you know, hype Aaron Rodgers. They're hyping him throughout Raw tonight with CM Punk's music. I thought, did you notice that, Tom, by the way?
The second time they aired the ad, it clicked with me, yeah. But it took, the second time they aired it, I was wondering how I didn't notice it the first time.
Because at first, I wasn't looking at the TV, I'm looking at my laptop, and I'm like, are they talking about CM Punk? Often misunderstood, an enigma where people think, you know, it's like they were basically describing Punk. And when I was watching Aaron Rodgers yesterday, I was like, he reminds me of CM Punk. So it's weird that they play his theme and then have this like narration for him. And it just sounded like they're talking about, you know, Mr. Phil Brooks, CM Punk. So, but anyway, that's a neither here nor there. But the NFL has high quality teams win and lose all the time, and it becomes part of the story. So my argument is, if WWE just did that almost always, they wouldn't fall in the trap of having fans think, well, we're not going to get an outcome here, so don't get wrapped up in near falls, or just feeling kind of like when the announcers don't even act like it's a big deal afterwards. Tonight, though, it worked. You know, I mean, this is one of those times where I think you can justify it, but it's why you pick your spots. And I thought, by the way, I thought Ray did a really good job tonight. You know, we talked about Dominic, and I talked about Edge being a pro. I think Ray's been really believable in this storyline. It's a pro wrestling universe. You know, it's not going to win an Emmy, spoiler alert, like Succession, in terms of, you know, its storytelling. But I think in the pro wrestling context with what they have to work with, I think Ray's been doing a really good job as that dad who's distressed. And, you know, he took that one opening from the Dominic vignette earlier in the show. And he came to his son and goes, I didn't know all that was going on. Why didn't you tell me? Now that I know, we can make things right. It's exactly how a desperate dad trying to get his son back, he would see, oh, that's new information. Let me use that to try to fix something that that's been tearing me apart inside since the clash. And Dominic wouldn't even look at him. So now it's just like, you know, you can imagine viewers at home wrapped up in the story, sympathizing with Ray, being upset with Dominic. And then you have this issue with Edge and wants to teach him a lesson, but Edge can't be too ruthless. But shoving Ray aside to get at Dominic is, I won't call it a cliffhanger, but it's an interesting part of this ongoing storyline. Is Ray going to go, I understand why you did what you did, Edge? Or is he going to be like, how could you shove me aside when I came out there to protect my son? Like, I assume that will be followed up on too. So a lot of moving parts here, but I think Ray deserves some compliments for his acting lately. And I think this is really good use of Ray at this stage of his career.
Yeah. Jimmy said, as I think it was Dominic was making his entrance, he said, it's a tale as old as Shakespeare. And I was like, you know what? I'll give him that one. There's a lot of complexity here. And yeah, you absolutely are seeing that from Ray's side and confronting Dom in the way he did after Dom went low and called him a tiny, tiny man, which I thought was a real nice touch. Like, you know, if Dom's going to turn on his dad, you want to go low with it. And that was low. So, I'm with you.
I debated whether I liked that line or not, and I'm still not sure. Because what you said is the positive side. Part of me is like, I know Dominic has turned on his dad, but it's like, it's about him. It's about Dominic wanting to break free, but I don't think it's his turning. I think his turning on his dad is more about him wanting to prove himself on his own. And, oh, yeah, whatever's going on off camera with Rhea Ripley, I don't know that I believe that he would just throw in Austin Theory-type petty insults at his dad like that. Like, I wasn't sure I believe that. I believe it when he says, you know, I'm not your baby boy anymore, I'm a man. Like, those kinds of lines work. But, and then it was also one of those lines where it was a little too written, you know, because it was for such a tiny, tiny man, you cast a large shadow and I'm done living under it. It almost, you know, like sometimes the writers write in a way where I can imagine, I'm trying to think who would say something like that. Like, I don't know that this young Dominic would have a way with words like that under these circumstances. I wish they wrote him less elegant, I guess. So I guess I'm talking myself into not liking the line, because if you're just, I mean, in a pro wrestling sense, if you're just trying to get heat on the heel, it was petty and mean spirited and that's unnecessary. I just didn't think it rang entirely true to me.
I guess if I'm trying to defend it, and admittedly it's a reach, but I'll say that maybe, you know, this being, you know, his father whom he's spent so much of his life with. You know, it's not all sunshine and rainbows, so maybe he has harbored a couple of really nasty insults that he hasn't said out loud, and now he's finally like, oh, now I'm going to unleash it. But maybe also I was just looking for something to like in that segment because I mean, it wasn't the worst concept ever, and Rhea leaning in the darkness to whisper in his ear like Lady Macbeth, another Shakespeare reference for you. That worked for me visually if perhaps being too theatrical, but Dominic is getting good heat from the crowd right now. And even if it means pushing off the Edge match another week, I feel like this is a segment you want to do in front of the crowd. And I worry the reason they didn't do it in front of the crowd is because Dom was clearly reading cue cards, and maybe that's something he's struggling with.
Jason Paul on ProWrestling.net said it reminded him, or it seemed like something maybe Paul Heyman produced, and he liked the segment. And I'm thinking, yeah, I wonder if Paul, you know, produced that. And it's the type of thing that you would have seen in ECW, but Paul Heyman or the wrestler he's producing would be holding a flashlight under their face. Like, it's very ECW-like in that sense, with a flashlight under his face. All right. on that note, let's go ahead and pause and formally introduce the show and then get to calls and emails. This is the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show for Monday, September 12th, 2022. I'm Wade Keller, the host of the show. I launched the Pro Wrestling Torch newsletter when I was in high school way back when, and continue to do that every week and have expanded to lots of different cool technologies over the years, hosted a radio show on KFAN. We had a 900 number during that era and launched apps when those were the big thing. And now we're big into podcasting. And I host a lot of podcasts throughout the week covering pro wrestling with different formats and different co-hosts, including VIP exclusive shows like The Fix with Todd Martin and everything with Rich Fan, and also the post pay-per-view roundtables and the Wade Keller hotlines, among other things. And my free shows include this, the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show, and the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast. And I appreciate you downloading or streaming our show today. We are covering Raw that just ended right before we went with our live stream. And the other voice you hear on today's show is Tom Staub from a couple VIP podcasts. Tom, welcome to the post show again. Welcome to the co-host chair.
Thanks so much. When last week they announced Johnny Gargano was going to be in action, I thought, ooh, I kind of hope I get the call for that one. So here I am. And if you are VIP, you can, maybe you already are, but you certainly can be listening to NXT 8 years back, which is weekly, dropping more or less on, NXT had a weird schedule in 2014, but more or less on the anniversary date, 8 years past the episode that we are covering. The most recent episode up on the feed, Kelly Wells and I are talking about the third ever NXT premium event called TakeOver Fatal 4-Way, which, among other things, featured the infamous Enzo Amore hair versus hair match that Kelly and I had completely opposite takes on. So one of us loved it, one of us hated it, and also featured one of the best, I wanted to use work in the word artistic, but the heel turn at the end of the show is one of the best instances of complex character storytelling. It's just miraculously pulled off and wonderful to relive. So that is NXT 8 years back, dropping on Saturdays. And then also monthly, I do the Bonus Point podcast, which is the perhaps too clever title for the WWE developmental podcast that primarily is filtered through NXT Level Up, hence the Bonus Point name, but I broaden it to developmental signings and tracking whatever news I can glean from what's going on at the Performance Center. For example, the most recent episode covers the departure of strength and conditioning coach Sean Hayes, who is switching over to working with the XFL, as well as the 31 new developmental signings down in NXT. Just wild how many people they just signed, some to NIL, some to just straight to the Performance Center. And
do you have them ranked
1
to 31 on chances to be? Do you have them ranked 1 to 31 already?
You know, I do actually have – I've figured out different hints that I can – there's so little – it's really like trying to solve mysteries, because we don't get great news – out of the developmental world is not full of headlines, but I've figured out a couple of little hints to see, like, okay, among this sea of names, here are two that maybe we should look for. And actually, I already have a decent track record, because Joe Spivak and I've forgotten the Nigerian man's name, but there were two people who is Odugbasan, something Odugbasan. They struck me as people who were kind of rising above the pack based on the very little I was seeing, and now they are officially signed after having joined the inaugural NIL class last year. So there's a little bonus point for me. And another thing that I am doing monthly now is trying to track where Bellator fighter Valerie Lareda, who is now signed and training at the Performance Center every day like everybody else, where her development is, because she definitely strikes me as somebody who will be a name that we are familiar with, for better or for worse, in the coming couple of years. So every month I'm giving an update on what she's been up to. So we're only halfway through September, and I'm already looking forward to recording the September episode of Bonus Point to talk about Valerie Lareda.
All right, cool. Let's get to phone calls and emails. I encourage our listeners who are live streaming us or have called in to participate. You can call if you haven't yet, 347-215-8558. That's 347-215-8558. And when you call, push 1 on your keypad. You can also email us at wadekellerpodcast@pwtorch.com. Anytime you're watching Raw, Dynamite, or SmackDown and you have thoughts on what you're watching or an observation that you think we might miss or a point of view on a controversial topic that you're sure we're going to talk about, send in those emails. And that's a good way to participate in the show, even if you aren't able to join us with our live stream after the show and instead choose to download it after the fact, which, of course, is what most people do, given the convenience of having it on demand instead of live streaming right afterwards. So with that all said, let's get to phone calls. And we'll begin with Justin in Charlotte, North Carolina. Justin, thanks for calling. What's on your mind tonight?
What's going on, fellas? Good to hear from you. Good to call in again. First thing I want to talk about is the lack of, which I don't mean this in a negative way, but the lack of, usually when WWE is up against competition, you know, Monday Night Football started, usually you feel like they're throwing in the towel, but I didn't really feel like this. I felt like this was a show that progressed stories, that progressed the programs that they got setting up for the next pay-per-view. So I just think it's very interesting to see how Levesque is running things versus Vince, who a lot of time felt like we're going up because they're going against the Emmys as well. So I just found it interesting, the contrast between Vince and Levesque as far as booking the show with competition. Did you guys think about that watching the show, or would you guys just enthralled with the show and didn't think about it too much?
Yeah, I mean, normally I think, well, are the Emmys really going to compete with Raw? But, like, my phone is just getting, you know, it's pelting me with little alerts from my news apps. You know, this is happening and that's happening. And so, you know, it can pull some people away from Raw. I felt like WWE, since they signed their big TV deals, and I think this applies to the transition from pay-per-view to the WWE Network and even more so to Peacock, they're always playing long ball. They're not trying to win the night by doing something that might move the needle a little bit. I think there's just sort of a confidence in their stride in that we're doing what we're doing. We've got paid to do what we do, and we're going to do it regardless of outside forces. And I think this lineup and this show could easily have aired last night, and it could easily air 3 weeks from now in terms of the marquee aspects of it. It didn't jump out to me as either waving the white flag or desperate hot-shotting. It felt like the next logical show to do on in the Raw TV series, regardless of the competition. But what do you think about that, Tom?
Yeah, the only reason I was aware that the Emmys were on tonight, it's not typically something I follow, is just because I've, like many other people, so I understand, although I haven't heard from any of them personally, I've recently become utterly obsessed with the show The Bear on Hulu. So anybody within the sound of my voice who doesn't mind constant curse words in their television, check out The Bear. Oh my gosh, I cannot give a greater endorsement to a television program. But I guess they missed the cutoff and didn't qualify for any awards. But I knew that the cast was in attendance and they were sharing posts about it. So that's how I was aware. But that selfish tangent aside, just because, oh my God, guys, The Bear is such a good show, you should watch it. I did not think about it much because I am engaged with the storylines going on Raw right now. And Justin, I'm glad that you brought that up just to help me take the step back to appreciate that, because I'm looking at the calendar and realizing, oh yeah, this is around the time of year that it's really trying to remain tuned in to the main roster product, because we get the doldrums of the, like you said, throwing in the towel against Monday Night Football, and then the doldrums of the Survivor Series build. Usually, there have been exceptions, but usually it's just a drag of a build that thankfully leads to quite often a very good show, in my opinion. But also, it's a bit of a relief coming from Paul Levesque, because we saw when he was going head-to-head on Wednesday nights that he was trying to make every show maybe more exciting than a weekly television show needed to be, and I felt that was to its detriment. And they were moving at breakneck paces, and I felt that the quality of NXT sharply declined during the quote-unquote Wednesday Night War. And so the fact that Monday Night Football comes back and we don't immediately see a similar shift is encouraging, I suppose.
All right, very good. Justin, back to you for more.
Yeah, I just appreciate that, just to be able to watch the show knowing that there seems to be a creative direction with storylines, and you're not seeing stuff happen then taken off television or forgotten and things like that. Two more topics I wanted to touch on for tonight's show. It feels like me and Todd Martin's the only people in the world, but I just haven't been impressed with this damage control group. You look online and it's like they're everybody's favorite group, but from promos to character motivation to just overall entertainment value, they just haven't been doing it for me. And I guess it's been less than 2 months, so it's too early to judge, I guess some would say, but from Bayley promos to Dakota and EO not really being as crisp in the ring as they normally are or was in NXT, it's just not doing it for me. And I know Bayley and Beyonce can perform in the ring, and I know their pay-per-view match will probably be good, but from a character standpoint and just week after week, I mean, Bayley was getting what chance tonight, which I wouldn't have expected that to happen before, but week after week with these draining promos and just coming out, just being juvenile, I just don't feel like it's working. I mean, do you guys have an opinion, or is it just too early for you guys?
Tom, what do you think?
I wish I could disagree with you, Justin. My how impressed I constantly am with Bayley's work, and it's such a treat getting to cover her again eight years back. She was so good even just coming right into the company, and you can see how right away they were pairing her with wrestlers, specifically Sasha Banks, who needed extra work because she was already the ring general who could help them get to the next step. My enthusiasm for Bayley's work will carry me through a lot, but I can't lie. What's going on with her right now doesn't have me excited. It's kind of got me scratching my head a little bit that she's aggravating Bianca to the point where Bianca wants to fight her and then just sort of being like, no, I don't want the match, which, I mean, we see other heels do that and it kind of works, but there's something that's just a flat note here that I can't quite figure out. And you're absolutely right. EO and Dakota were very sharp in NXT, and Dakota wasn't away that long. Ring Rust works in different ways, but she's had some time now to kick it off. And, both EO and Dakota seem as though they've lost at least a half step in every single match they've been in on the main roster thus far. So yeah, it's unfortunate, especially after the momentous return that that they had as a trio. But yeah, it's not clicking with me yet. And I think maybe we're past the point now where they don't have a mission statement, because clearly Bayley is in a program with Bianca for that championship, and clearly the tag titles, meant something to them, and they achieved that tonight. But yeah, it has not clicked yet.
What have you seen in Bayley in the past that made you more hopeful that this incarnation of her would be better? Is there something she's shown you before that she could be doing that for some reason isn't part of this current act? Or is she just, does it seem like she's just sort of phoning it in, and it's just maybe she's at a different stage of her life, and so she's kind of, I'm a heel, I'm going to sell to a local audience, and I'm going to just, kind of just instinctively make my way through this character, but I'm not trying to reinvent myself, and that's just kind of where we are with her at this point.
You just said it, in not trying to reinvent herself, and not that everybody has to be Chris Jericho every single week and come up with a new T-shirt every single promo, but Bayley is somebody who, me and many other people were just like, well, she could never turn heel. This person could never be a heel. What? She was such a baby face of a baby face, and then she did, and it was like, oh my gosh, this was in her all along. She's doing so well, and coming up with the ding-dong thing and razzing Michael Cole, and just being obnoxious and slicing down her Bailey buddies. And now that she's back, every time she's out, I'm so excited to see her and my faith is in her. But then it's just like playing the hits. Like, you know, she the only thing new about her is the red hair color. I don't know what the new wrinkle is, but I think I do need a new wrinkle from now this new, what should be a new incarnation of heel Bailey.
What did you make of Bailey blaming Io Sky for being inexperienced at tag team wrestling and pinning the wrong person, and Io Sky's reaction to it? Because at first I thought, oh God, they're breaking them up already. Io Sky, they're already hinting at Io being a babyface, because she sort of, it seemed like she didn't like being shown up or scolded by Bailey like that. But then I thought, well, maybe she just was sort of, her body language was, yeah, I kind of let the team down and I'm upset with myself. But at least, you know, I have a chance to, I don't know. I wasn't quite sure what to make of the body language in the exchange there.
Yeah, full disclosure, I would have to replay it to examine EO's body language. For Bailey's part, I just took it as typical heel deflection. Like they don't want to own up to what happened, so they just to the truth of it, so they just deflect. Like, oh yeah, don't, that didn't bother us. No, we're moving on.
Yeah. All right, Justin, anything else for us?
Last thing I want to talk about was obviously what I felt like the highlight of the show, which was the Kevin Owens promo with Theory. And, the work Kevin Owens has been doing since Triple H taking over has really shown what he's been capable of doing all of these years, even though he's been good at doing whatever else they've put him as. But as far as Theory in the promo, with the segment, I remember calling a few months ago talking about that edge I feel that Theory needs to kind of get to that main event level. And you kind of seen it a little bit with the segment tonight. And I'm hoping going forward that he can kind of lose the selfie stuff, kind of lose the Weasley heel thing, and just become a little more vicious, just become a little more sadistic in the way he moves and stuff, be a little more calculated. And I think, you know, as time goes on, he could eventually get to that main event level. But I felt like this was definitely a step in the right direction. That's my last topic, and hope you guys have a good show.
Thanks, Justin. Always good to hear from you. Thanks for calling. First of all, I was thinking of leading with that, but Javier is waiting to be on, and he messaged me during the show with thoughts on Kevin Owens and Theory. So I was like, well, maybe we'll get to Javier before we go in depth on that and get his take on it. But I still look forward to his expanded take on it. But that was a highlight of the show, maybe the highlight of the show, to each their own, in terms of making a pick for the highlight. I was struck by it feeling like, because we haven't seen Paul Levesque and Stephanie McMahon with a presence on TV other than Stephanie on SmackDown giving the most minimal of send-offs to her dad after, you know, nearly 40 years in charge. You know, the bare minimum to not seem like they're burying him, but also not going so far as to draw criticism for celebrating him too much, given the context of things. And what was the one Triple H reference in the last couple of weeks on TV? It's slipping my mind.
I remember that there was one, but was it somebody saying like, we know how, Dakota Kai did say we know how to play the game, but I don't think that's, I know what you were talking about, but I don't remember what it was. There was one.
Yeah. There. So, but that's a testament, you know, that hasn't been the Paul Levesque show. It isn't, hello everybody, this is the new era. You know, he's not out there, you know, by the way, Brian Gewirtz's story on Triple H being all self-conscious when Gort started making fun of the way he over-enunciated his words at the end, and Paul Levesque didn't seem to like that and then stopped doing it, is one of the highlights of Brian Gewirtz's new book, the longtime creative team member in WWE. So anyway, my point is, getting back to this, is he hasn't been real prominent on the air, but he hasn't like walked out and made a mission statement. This is what it's going to be all about. I mean, how much did we got that with Bischoff and Russo? You know, we're resetting things and it's going to be better. And, you know, TNA's gone through that in different ways. So to me, this was as close as we got to just sort of sneaking in a way to tell us through a wrestler promo one key thing that's going to be different that Paul Levesque is proud of compared to Vince McMahon, but it was done in a way as not to create awkwardness at Thanksgiving at the dinner table, you know, where it just seems like something natural Kevin Owens would say, but it's also some, it's also a way for Levesque to say, hey, everybody, you know, who maybe shifted over to AEW or liked NXT during the takeover era, I'm here and things are different in this way. And we're going to have Kevin Owens overtly explain it, but it works totally on a storyline level because Theory was literally Vince McMahon's chosen one. And now Vince McMahon is gone. So for Kevin Owens to say it doesn't work that way anymore is actually totally in the normal natural flow of the canon of Raw proper. In terms of what he might say under those circumstances. So, Tom, what do you think of what was said, and how do you feel about my framing it as maybe Levesque finally finding a way to kind of sneak in a way, not to pat himself on the back, but to get a highlighter out and go, for those of you watching, people like Gargano and Kevin Owens are going to get a better chance because they're that good, and Theory is going to have to prove himself. He's not going to have that leg up that he had when the other guy was in charge.
Well, I'll admit that I did not – that was not my takeaway in the moment. But I do think that you're onto something, and who else – who better to go out there and say those things in that way than Kevin Owens, who usually does have some sort of double speak that he's got going on, the what he's saying – in character and storyline, and then the cute meaning to the side as well, the double meaning. So I think it absolutely works in that regard. And speaking directly to who was introduced to us, reintroduced to us as Vince's guy, but the promo really worked for me on just the character and storyline level as well. And this is after, like, halfway into this whole segment, I was just sort of writing it off as, not in a negative way, but just like, okay, these guys are always good at what they do. They're out there being good at what they do again. Okay. But then Kevin really started firing up. Well, you know what? Even before that, I did take note of how focal Owens was, not just on himself, but on Gargano. He kept on mentioning Gargano as, like, the same breed of wrestler as him. You know, Owens, a much more reputable and storied name on this level of television, and just really, and who's being presented as a popular, as a babyface right now, and being accepted crowd after crowd as a popular babyface, and just validating Gargano, somebody who they are trying to prove at that level, and being very careful with, so far as we'll get to. But when Kevin really fired up, it wasn't just what Owens was saying. I loved Theory's body language. Theory, who always faces everything head on, but in just sort of like the stupid heel kind of way, the brash, like, oh, this isn't really going to work, you're going to get punched in the face by Tyson Theory kind of way. But now he's being presented with a hard reality and being told that real work needs to go into achieving what he wants to achieve, and he couldn't look Owens in the face, and he was turning away, and he was stepping back. And it was so effective that I feel, at least from where I was sitting, it accomplished a moment where I was thinking, you know, I want Austin Theory as a character to rise to this occasion, to look Owens in the eyes and to say, you know what, you're right, and I'm going to do this the right way. But of course, we're not at that point in any kind of story yet. So it's fine that it didn't go that way, but it made me want that, which I think is an important moment in the journey that we're on with Austin Theory here, the climbing of the ladder that I believe we are going to see with him. I think this was a really important character moment in that way. I thought it was brilliantly played. And then you had the nice little touch. Almost 8 years on, Kelly and I aren't quite to Kevin Owens' NXT debut, but almost 8 years on, a nice what played almost as if a callback to Owens getting his nose bloodied by CJ Parker in his debut, and that really being a part of Owens' look when he introduced himself to us on the NXT stage. you know, Austin Theory looking quite similarly with his own nose bloodied by Owens.
The people in WWE whose opinion I respect are very high on Theory. People are rooting for him. I know it sort of defies his on-air persona and perhaps some perceptions of immaturity off-air, but he, from what I'm told, is a student of the game who wants to be mega successful and is approaching everything the right way. I'm not going to say, like, I know inside and out as a person he's someone you would want to root for, if that matters to you when it comes to your entertainers. I just don't know enough about him either way in that regard. But on a professional level, there's a reason that he's getting TV time, not just because he was one of Vince McMahon's guys, but continuing to get a push under Paul Levesque. I think a lot of people were sort of thinking, oh, that push is going to go away. Veer's push has gone away. The 24/7 title has gone away. You know, we can point to things. Omos's push is different and not as omnipresent. But Theory just is continuing going in the flow of the push he had. So And part of the reason that people are into him is, one, he's delivering in the ring. And Javier, make a note to speak of him, because I know you have opinions on him you've expressed to me, probably on the show, but I know in a DM also. But what you described tonight about things he's good at with a body language are the things that people in WWE appreciate about the way that they tell stories on air beyond a bunch of high spots and athletic, dazzling moves in the ring. He does those other things that WWE covets and values and shines spotlights on. He expects people in top spots to be able to do. He does it, and not everybody does.
Yeah, and at this point in wrestling, when we've seen everything that can be done, high spots are disposable. This kind of acting and storytelling is not. This is the kind of stuff that gets us to latch on, the stuff that we remember, and the stuff that makes those high spots more meaningful when he performs them. Everything that you're saying about what you're hearing about him backstage, I think we see the proof of that in how well he is performing as a character on the microphone and in the ring. My hopes are high.
All right, cool. Let's move to Ryan in Cumberland, Maryland. Ryan, what have you got for us tonight? Thanks for calling.
Hi, first question is on the Rey Mysterio-Dominic feud. Do you think they'll focus the story around Rey's daughter, since they mentioned her by name tonight, maybe have her be conflicted on whether to join the Judgment Day or side with Rey?
I hadn't thought about that. What do you think, Tom?
I have a hard time foreseeing Aaliyah becoming a part of a storyline again. Maybe I will be proven wrong as soon as next week, but I think what we saw recently with, I guess it was Rey's 20th anniversary with WWE at MSG, when, you know, the Mysterio family was backstage, I could see her maybe appearing in that capacity and just lending a little more emotional gravitas to what's going on with Rey and Dom. But I think I would be surprised if they involved her more directly in the story.
Yeah, I would be too. I mean, I wouldn't rule it out, but it doesn't jump out to me, at least at this stage. But I guess in the end, she might say, hey, you know, Dominic, I know what's going on here. Let me speak some truth to you. What else, Ryan?
Okay, second question is, Emmis has been off TV since Triple H has been on the creative side of things or had more of an influence on creative sides. So my question is, what has Emmis been doing? Has he been down refining his skills in the ring in Florida, or has he been just taking a little vacation or something else going on?
Who are you talking about? I'm sorry?
Emmis, like, was on TV tonight for the first time in about a month or so.
Yeah, well, he was on. I thought you were saying Elias at first, and because that fits too. obviously, he's less infatuated with that gimmick. Although I think in a way that's just trying. I think they've decided Kevin Owens is more important, so let's get him his characters off the screen until, you know, we reintroduce them. So I'm curious about that. But anyway, yeah. I mean, Omos was on tonight and squashed a couple jobbers, but Omos is not getting a super push. But I also think Paul Levesque, well, Tom, I'm curious, do you think it's something where you just go, no, he's not ready, it's not what the type of thing Levesque is known for promoting? Or is there, and so you just cut bait, or do you go, nah, we've invested enough in him, let's keep him around. The timing's not quite right to do anything big with him, but there'll come a time, and so we'll just kind of keep him out there every once in a while. Or is that middle ground that we're in now too much of a downshift from what seemed like a major character, where it sort of undercuts the whole notion that he's this unstoppable force? What do you think?
Man, I mean, we've seen, like, it happened with Bianca Belair for a long time. She was just on the back burner on NXT. She would work maybe one match of taping. They would remind us she was there. But she, I always use the term back burner with her, back burner BB. And, you know, it's kind of like maybe the Nikki Cross formula would have been better, where if there wasn't anything going on with Nikki Cross, she wouldn't appear. You know, she would disappear for a long time, and when she came back, we had missed her, and we wanted to see her again, and there was, you know, something new that Nikki Cross could be doing. I feel like if there isn't something for Omos in the near future, then keeping him off is better. And he's, you know, he is a genuinely impressive human being to see in person. He's the best I can tell you, Ryan, about what you know, what he's been doing in the meantime, and I don't know any other details. It's just that he's been making the house show dates, so he's on the road with his roster. So, you know, yeah, have this guy on the house shows, because you are going, your jaw is going to hit the floor when you see him in person. He's just so freaking massive. But yeah, I don't know, just going out there and squashing whoever Cash Marazzi and Ryan Toombs really are and whiffing on a kick and then missing, you know, overshooting the turnbuckle. So the guy has to like smash his own head down into the turnbuckle pad in midair. You know, just not looking great.
That wasn't good.
I don't know if, no.
Dominic had the fourth worst match of the night. Now that you bring that up, Dominic really actually was, you know, how many matches were on this show? Six? He was like top two, if that's
yeah,
the case.
There you go. Yeah. I'm not sure tonight was a great chapter in the story of Omos.
Yeah. So, yeah, so we had the Chad Gable Gargano match, too.
And Finn Riddle.
Okay. So, yeah, so that puts him at number three. Yeah, he had the third best match, but the fourth worst match, right in the middle. That's pretty good. I think he can be content with that. A lot of pressure going, you know, having a main event on Raw. Okay. Anyway, back to you, Ryan.
Oh, I do want to counter something that, your co-host said. MS just returned to the house.
Get ready, Tom.
Against Paisley, according to 9:10, which would have been Saturday against Matt Riddle. And Riddle picked up the victory by DQ. He hadn't been on Raw since August 8th, and I don't see any house show results since then.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, I was pulling up his track record to see if I could get any more information on – I already scrolled away from their fake names. But, you know, the two jobbers, and it didn't get updated in time for the show. But I admit I looked at that Matt Riddle match and I thought, oh, he's making house shows, and I didn't look further. So thank you for the correction.
Okay, my final question is on Chad Gable. I noticed he did the rookie steamboat move where he, you know, gets back in the ring by like coming upside down over the top rope, and about a few months ago Tiffany Stratton had a lot of trouble like doing that move. Like she didn't do the move altogether and just gave up. So is there like a secret to doing that move? Because I thought, you know, Chad Gable would have a lot harder time since he's a lot bigger, but maybe just more muscular. Is there something else to do that move?
What do you think, Bob?
In the as Byron Saxton showed us tonight, as he would call it, the alternative timeline in which wrestling school became more accessible while I was still in my 20s rather than already in my 30s with back issues, I would have an answer for you. But because I've never been to wrestling school, I am not sure.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know either. You know what I was struck by? One, you know, like Gargano's existed in this other universe, Chad Gable in this one, and they cross paths. And it's fun to see them just – it felt like sort of a Bryan Danielson thing of let's just go out and let's just do our thing. Let's mat wrestle. It wasn't – sometimes I think Bryan Danielson can be self-indulgent, but it almost always works out really well. And this felt like self-indulgent, and it worked out well too in the sense that let's just mat wrestle and kind of not hit the ropes and not do a bunch of WWE-type stuff. And it was fun. But my original point was size-wise, I'm always interested when people from – different areas kind of stand next to each other and how it blows up your perception of their size. And that struck me with Riddle and Balor when they were standing like eye to eye. I think people perceive Balor, and maybe I'm wrong, but perceive Balor as a smaller wrestler, you know, on the smaller height-wise on the lower end of main eventers, and Riddle as probably medium to medium high. Like I just, maybe I'm wrong, but that's kind of how I think he's portrayed, and they just stood eye to eye. Like, it made me think Riddle's shorter than I thought and Balor's taller than I thought. Now, Balor had boots on and Riddle's barefoot. So, you know, if Balor's barefoot, then there is going to be a size difference. But that struck me a little bit too. And I was thinking about the same thing with Gable and Gargano and how thick Gable looked compared to Gargano. So anyway, do you think my perception of how people, my take on how people perceive the size of Riddle and Balor is correct, Tom?
Yes, and I think it has a lot to do with presence. For example, Rhea Ripley always strikes me as a, you know, in wrestler terms, a bigger woman. She's one of the bigger female wrestlers. But I've stood right next to Rhea Ripley in the Full Sail parking lot, and I feel like I dwarf her. I'm 6'2", and I, off the top of my head, I want to say she's 5'7". She might be 5'10". It's been a while since I looked it up. I used to have it memorized. But it surprised me when I went up to her to find that I was that much smaller than her, and I felt she was so much smaller than me because when she's in the ring, even in that small Full Sail studio and seeing her perform at the tapings and the live NXTs for the years that I did, she always struck me as a larger person. And like Adam Cole is another example. I've never thought of Adam Cole as a smaller wrestler because his personality is so big and I feel like he outperforms his size. And then you look at someone like Johnny Gargano and maybe he's physically small enough that, or maybe plays into his height with his wrestling style enough or his personality that he doesn't outperform it per se, but you know, it as I've invested in the wrestler that he is and the character that he portrays, you know, the size doesn't matter for me, you know, whether it's an asset or not, but certainly you get that visual, something that struck, that was something that struck me watching Clash at the Castle, which, just as an aside, was a show that absolutely blew me away. I thought it was so freaking good. And I thought it was takeover-esque in the way that it was put together. So that was one of my main takeaways there. But you look at the main event, and even in that massive stadium, Drew McIntyre goes out there and he feels like he's standing on top of everybody. And it doesn't matter if you're up in a nosebleed, you can see him. So that there is that important element to it. And I've said over and over again about McIntyre that I feel like as soon as he enters a room, he commands it. So he's got that going for him. But yeah, I mentioned earlier that I feel they are being extremely careful with every Gargano, every detail of how they are presenting Gargano right now. And this is coming from, of course, Paul Levesque being experienced in presenting Johnny Gargano. And yes, on a different kind of stage. But I feel like it was absolutely deliberate. You know, you and I talked about the strategy of presenting him in front of a Toronto crowd, a crowd that is typically more invested in the wrestling product and a crowd that is familiar with Johnny Gargano from the takeovers that he performed at. And Jimmy Smith took my factoid away from me that the last time they were in Portland, it was for NXT Portland, the last takeover before the pandemic shut things down. And Johnny Gargano was like third match on the card or something like that, wrestling Finn Balor right after having turned heel for a second time, I believe, on NXT. So even though that's not as significant as the timeless tag match that Gargano had in Toronto and then the signature best 2 out of 3 that he had against Adam Cole in the main event at another takeover, it's still is better than Kansas City last week. You know what I mean? So I think they're being deliberate in putting him in front of the crowd, crowds who are more predisposed to liking him than other crowds. And I thought it was a deliberate choice to, well, obviously a deliberate choice to pick his opponent, but really, really carefully pick not just the size of opponent, but somebody who he has experience with. Yeah, it's been a few years, but of course, Gable and Gargano wrestled in NXT in DIY and American Alpha, and they didn't have like a full blown feud or anything, but they had matches, and I'm sure they had even more than that on house shows. Speaking of, and Ryan, I actually did scroll when I looked at our Gable's recent house show history. I was looking for Gargano and Gable matches to see if they had kind of practiced with one another. To make sure, again, just thinking about being careful in the presentation of Gargano to make sure that crowds take to him in the way Triple H, Paul Levesque wants crowds to take to him. And I did not see any. I just saw Gable mostly working with KO. So yeah, they seem to have just gone out there and called it because these are two guys that they know can do that. And at risk of going too long on the subject, the only thing I think is the risk there is having somebody like Gargano that, you know, Paul Levesque clearly liked everything that Gargano said in his return promo, even I'm kind of a big deal and even I want the WWE championship one day, because they replayed all of that. And this is somebody that they Triple H wants to be a big deal, and he's in there going as long as he did and taking as long as he did to put away a comedy heel. And Gable, we know Gable's ability, but he is presented as a lower level comedy heel. So at this level, in a character that we are going to see, that I believe we are going to see scratch and claw as an underdog, that's probably not too much of a risk now, but it is a risk moving forward on the same show where we just saw Bianca Belair take as long as she did to put away Sonya Deville. And from the same person who booked 8 years ago, championship contender Sami Zayn, who had been on top of the card for as long as he had been at that point and was going into a takeover main event for the championship, he booked him in a 3 or 4 minute long match, which was basically just him working from underneath Marcus Louis, an assistant to a low card heel, who was not a threat to anybody. And still Sami Zayn took longer than he should have to put away Marcus Louis. And that's coming from the same creative mind. So a risk moving forward there, I think.
Booker should be cognizant of this will be a really good match. Let's have them go long. If it's still a mismatch in terms of the rankings or the depth chart or how fans perceive them. What did you make of the commentary, Graves in particular, saying that Gargano likes to get too showy? He likes to show off and get fancy. He brought that up at least twice in the match at times when Gargano was doing something that was a cool move, not a conventional move that you would see most wrestlers do or a sequence. And it backfired, and Graves was like, yeah, that's Gargano getting too fancy. It's like, is that what you want to say about Johnny Wrestling the babyface against Chad Gable the heel, is make it seem like Gargano, this, you know, decade and a half veteran, just isn't disciplined enough to stick to trying to win and he gets fancy?
I didn't pick up on that, but oh man, I didn't feel like this particular match was one to accuse of that, but it probably is too true of a thing to say, even for the heel leaning Corey Graves color commentary, because There are definitely points in Gargano's career where it's like, okay, we have so much evidence of you being an incredible in-ring storyteller, but this time it seems like you're wrestling for the stars. So, you know, we can see through it, Johnny. I don't know if you want commentary pointing that out, because I think it might be too true.
This is also part of my quest to cause Javier to angrily scratch off every one of his talking points that he think he'd have for us late in the show that we wouldn't get to. So we'll find out. Ryan, is there anything else for us before we move on?
Final questions on Bayley. Do you know if she's recovered 100%? Because she appears to be like in six woman matches and also has a manager role. And I don't think she's really done a real long singles match yet. So do you know if she's like 90% now or 100%?
I am a little worried. Yeah, I'm a little worried about that. What have you picked up on, Tom, from either reports, house show, frequency of any kind? I mean, she even drew attention to the fact that, you know, hey, Bianca, I beat you in my first match in over a year, and you haven't lost in over 300 days. But I'm getting a little worried about the fact that, like, they're not ready to showcase her in what she does in the ring. And, I mean, you know, her talking, her character work has been a feature, not a flaw for her in her career. But her in-ring work was integral in her being as big of a star as she became. And now they're subtracting that from her presentation so far in her return. So what have you heard? And then also, does that concern you at all?
Yeah, unfortunately, I haven't heard anything. And this was I did not scroll through her house show history at all. So I'm not certain there. But I, you know, when Bianca goes out there, she's gotten to a point where she feels like she is a big personality on the show. And I feel like Bayley is similarly a big personality on the show. So it's a feud that makes sense because you have two of the biggest personalities in the women's division going head to head. And so I honestly haven't thought about it too much. Bayley, of course, had a prolonged recovery. But, you know, we saw her go as long as she did. There's another example of going as long as she did to beat Aaliyah a few weeks ago in her first match back. And then being in the sixth person. But I think to this point, I've just considered it, you know, she's a big personality. She's not going to wrestle every single week. And when she's threatened, she's going to put Dakota and Io in front of her, which, of course, could just be playing into it's obviously playing into the concern, and maybe there is that health reason that they are doing it. But I personally haven't picked up on it just because it does seem to make so much sense for the character at this time.
All right. We'll go. And there, Ryan, any closing words or anything else?
The Leon match went 6 minutes, 45 seconds. So it wasn't a real long match. That is my final word.
Okay. Yeah. All right, good. Ryan, I always appreciate it. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking the call.
Of course. All right, we'll go next to area code 276. 276, thanks for calling. What's on your mind tonight? First, state your name and where you're calling from.
I'm Brian from Virginia.
Hey, Brian, thanks for calling. Yeah, what do you think of Raw tonight?
This is fairly well, Wade. I just wanted to touch on a subject and ask you your opinion. You know, you've covered wrestling for a very long time, and it seems like, you know, in the early 90s and the 80s, like the, you know, characters in that area, it was just so exciting and, you know, such a, you know, thrill to, you know, see those characters, you know, match up with certain characters. But it seems like now, like, so many of the characters are so similar. And it's just, you know, it just feels, you know, so kind of blasé. Do you know what I'm saying? Kind of like when you had Warrior and Hogan.
Yeah. So, Brian, give me a few other names that you think sort of epitomize the diversity of characters that you have in mind. And I'm wondering if you're mostly WWE based, and so it's sort of like, you know, Macho Man Randy Savage and. Or if you go back to the 80s with King Kong Bundy and Don Morocco, like what's jumping up?
All that. And King Kong Bundy, Andre the Giant is so diverse. You had Hogan, you had Macho Man, you had Ultimate Warrior, you had, you know, Don Morocco, you had, you know, all these different ones in different, you know, categories. And they was, you know, you knew their place on the card, but you also knew, you know, what the superior matches was, you know, at the time. Now it seems like your main event, you know, there's not really anybody you can pick out of, you know, WWE's roster that they epitomize other than Roman Reigns, and they're having such a hard time to find anybody to match up to Roman Reigns, and they have so many, you know, other similar guys, you know, as far as like, you know, they just mix in together. As far as, you know, in the ring.
So Brian, who do you think on today's WWE roster is a good example of what you think there should be more of, but there's just not enough of.
I enjoy a lot of the wrestling, like Johnny Gargano and, you know, people like that. I enjoy the wrestling, but I just don't feel like the characters are coming out as, you know, strongly as far as, you know, like you know, we was talking about the 80s and the 90s. It was just so, you know, strong characters.
Sure.
I just wonder why they can't bring out.
Brian, I understand that question. I'm wondering, is there somebody that you think today on today's roster that you think is a good example of what they should look for more? Like, do you like Kevin Owens? Do you like Omos? Do you like Austin Theory? Do you like Dolph Ziggler? Do you like Riddle? Is there somebody that you think would have fit in well back then, for instance?
Back then? The only one that I can really epitomize as far as now, right now, in the last couple of years, is maybe Roman Reigns could fit in that time. As far as, you know,
okay,
that time. It's like if a lot of the other ones seemed like they would fit on an undercard if you put them in the 80s. And it was like you can go back on WWE Network and go through, you know, that time period, and it's just like you can see so much difference. You know, you had four pay-per-views here, and those pay-per-views, I mean, they were so exciting at that time. And then now it's like they have one every month, but they can't, you know, even at WrestleMania time, they have a problem trying to build it up to where they had to bring stars in from the outside, you know, even to build it up to that level, you know?
Brian, I don't want to assume your age. Did you watch the wrestling back then in real time, or are you a younger fan who's gone back and watched that and think it's better? Like, which category do you fall into?
I've been watching it ever since that time. I started watching around 1988 and,
okay,
you know, grew up in that,
yep,
period and moved up, you know, through the years. I kind of stopped when Hogan went away because he was my favorite at that time, you know. I stopped watching,
yep,
about 93, come back in 94 and watched, you know, WCW through that area because, you know, they bring back so many of the stars and they mix them together with, you know, stars of WCW that I actually hadn't, you know, watched that much of until that time period. You know, I knew about Ric Flair,
cool,
and I knew about Lex Luger and all those, but, you know, didn't know, you know, know them until I actually watched around 95. Well, then, you know, I kept watching all the way through the 2000s, all the way up to now, but it just seems like it kind of drizzled down to where, you know, the stars are,
so,
don't seem,
yeah,
to be characters.
Right. You know. Let me jump in because I don't want to lose my train of thought on things that you've brought up that I want to respond to, and I want to have time to talk to Tom about this too. So I asked him about his age because, you know, sometimes people just are nostalgic for when they were first a fan. And so that could be at work with Brian, as opposed to if he's 23 and he just is going back and watching old stuff and saying, hey, it was way better back then for what I would like to see in wrestling. So that's why I asked about his age, because we all kind of have a bias towards the era that brings us in as fans and have a nostalgia for that. That said, I felt like Vince McMahon was fighting his instincts or trying to have it both ways and always wanted to go back to characters, even when the Attitude Era and beyond, there was a movement more towards wrestlers who were more like actual regular people. So it seemed like Vince was always sort of, you know, fighting his instinct. Okay, I got to be modern, so I got to have Kevin Owens come out in the T-shirt and just cut great promos. But I want to also have my Elias, who's got a guitar and wears jeans in the ring. And he's, you know, Elias could drop into 1990 or 92 and be like, yep, that totally fits that era. And I am curious where Paul Levesque goes as far as that goes. Like, we've seen him try to reinvent or put a fresh coat of paint on the Viking Raiders. We've seen Veer, who would have been somebody that Brian might be looking back on. I don't know if I'd say fondly, but as an example of the distinct characters of the late 80s or the mid to late 80s and early 90s when he first started watching wrestling. And Levesque sidelined him for now. But, you know, there's still, you know, characters on the show. But, you know, I think he's going to augment Baron Corbin and Madcap Moss is going to probably be a little bit less less of what Vince was doing and a little bit more grounded. So what do you think about that comparison, and what have you seen in Levesque so far that makes you both from NXT and now on the main roster? And do you agree with my assessment of Vince that he was sort of fighting the – trying to sneak in the 80s version of WWF into the 90s and new, you know, 2000s era of what pro wrestling had become?
I definitely agree with you about Vince, and so much of it is just trying to find that middle ground, like the middle ground between the mid-90s WWF when you had these cartoonish characters, some that worked, like Undertaker and Doink, and some that were Duke the Dumpster Drozzy, all due respect. And then, you know, the middle ground between that and then something like NXT UK, where it just seems like every single guy that comes out there is wearing black trunks and has a beard and a shaved head. And that's an exaggeration. When you actually watch the show, it's not like that, but it's hard to discern, you know, one match from the next and really find people to latch onto. They all kind of blend together. And I do feel like one of the many reasons why so many of us really responded to Levesque era NXT is because it felt like a middle ground where characters could be characters but also be taken seriously as realistic people. So that's one of the many reasons why I remain optimistic about Levesque's booking. And just in a macro sense, and I don't know how specifically, A, that we would even want to, but B, that I even could talk too much on the subject, but I think a lot of it just has to do with culture shifting over the years and media consumption shifting over the years. And, of course, what we talk about almost every single time that I'm on with you, Wade, is just the overexposure and just how many hours of television there are, and especially – you know, the latter years of Vince just having like Street Profits versus the Usos for 5 months in a row, you know, Baron Corbin versus Seth Rollins for 3 months in a row coming out of WrestleMania. And you're just like, oh my goodness. But you know, I'll point to, again, something like Clash at the Castle. The reason I said I felt it was takeover-esque is because the card was pared back to, just off the top of my head, I think 6 matches, not a beefy card, not the usual takeover 5, but 6 matches. And as a result, each of them felt big. And so even if going into it, I mean, I'm going to take the Gunther versus Sheamus example, and there are those of us, you know, probably many of us who looked at the build and we were just like, oh man, this is going to be a potential show stealer of a match. But maybe the storyline wasn't there. Maybe these haven't been the most dynamic characters. Maybe Sheamus has been around so long that we take him for granted, so on and so forth. But you get on that stage when it's been set up for that match to feel like the biggest thing in the world when it is happening. And I feel like even though, you know, Brian, you've got 10 years on me, I started watching in 98, I have gone back and I have, I almost feel like I have nostalgia for wrestling that I wasn't watching in the moment when it comes to 80s wrestling. I love going back and watching shows, and they feel way better than what we get now. But you get those Roman-like characters that were kept special, and they weren't, Hogan wasn't on every single show, and when he showed up, it was more special. And then I definitely have the rose-colored glasses regarding the Attitude Era when I really became a fan and started watching. But then you look at Gunther versus Sheamus at Clash at the Castle, and I would absolutely hold the significance of the moment that I felt that we got there, that Sheamus and Gunther achieved there. I would hold that up to those prior eras and big moments there as well. So I don't think it's completely gone for what that's worth.
All right, very good. Let's switch now to our Javier segment. Javier, PW Torch VIP contributor, PWTorch.com contributor. It is time for our roundtable segment here on the post show with Javier. Welcome.
Hey, Wade. Hey, Tom. How's it going?
Good. Have we left you with talking points?
Not really. particularly Tom.
Okay, good.
And, you know,
let's play you out here. We'll play you out.
He,
oh, no.
he, uh, he thoroughly dissected that Kevin Owens promo and the Austin Theory, which I mean, and that dovetails with the two things of like how good Austin Theory is the little things. And I mean, down to the point where like I was ready for Austin Theory to turn face right there.
absolutely.
Yeah, so,
I agree.
You did. I mean, and those are like the best moments because, you know, and then when he just flexes his, I mean, I know you got a kick out of that way where all he just flexes, and I'm like, oh man, he's just such a, you know, but he did, you know, fire back after he got hit and he didn't wilt away. And that's one of the things I've noticed about his character lately, that even though he's been less of a goofball and like there've been moments where he's actually stood his ground. And instead of just, you know, tucking his tail and running away, he's, you know, more of the goofball stuff he's done is more like slipping on a banana peel, like getting knocked out by Tyson Fury and getting like immediately knocked out in SummerSlam, that sort of thing. But, yeah, I mean, I just between the Kevin Owens speech and the Moxie speech over in AEW, it like two of the best promos that I've heard in a long time. You know, within less than 7 days of each other.
Yeah, I love that Paul Levesque seems to not only recognize but appreciate and want to feature what Kevin Owens is best at. And he didn't waste time. Like, he was a priority for him. Like, okay, you're sitting here doing comedy, obsessed with Ezekiel and Elias being the same person. We think we can do more with you than that. Let's just get to it. And you know, I think he's earned it so far, for sure.
And the content which you guys already touched on, which is the idea that we're not usually the wrestlers that get pushed in the Vince McMahon ecosystem, and you know, even though basic Kevin Owens made himself undeniable, because there are many times that he got, you know, busted down, and mm-hmm. then. You know, he was so good that,
yeah.
that he had to be put in important stuff, to the point where like when he ran out of people, he put the title on them. so, you know, so, and that's the thing. And then like him really underscoring that, you know, that it's a different era. And what I like is him telling Austin Theory, you can belong, you know, we're not saying you can't belong. You could belong, but you got to show the, you know, the same kind of fire and drive that we do. And I mean,
yeah.
I'm hoping, well, I mean, I don't think it's because, I mean, this could also have been a message kind of thing. I don't
mm-hmm.
know how he is, you know, I mean, he is in the back, but like if it could be a, you know, if you get fired up and if he's just, you know, because obviously he's a heel, so he's not really that kind of, you know, character. So I don't know if he is, like, you know, backstage or not. But, you know, it's great for his development. And got to keep in mind, he's also young. So he's going to be around for a long time, and you don't want to just – well, I mean, I guess you kind of did that with Jay White over in New Japan. But, you know, you don't want to just immediately throw him, you know, all the way to the top. Because, people are like – Yeah, and people are, you know, and people are resenting him, but they're resenting him, like, in a good way, because it doesn't feel like he has go-away heat. I mean, maybe for some people, because
I think some people
are just jackasses, but...
Well, yeah, but I think he's delivering what's asked of him so far. You know, I mean, nobody's saying he's going to come in and, you know, whatever, be as polished as Jay White is now in certain ways, or whatever, but he's so good at this stage for what WWE wants the top guy to be. And I don't think, I mean, from what I've heard, and I don't think the body of the totality of what I've heard is enough to offset an alternate view of him. But what I've heard is it would make me think that wasn't Kevin Owens trying to send him a message as much as it was storyline, and that, you know, Theory is respected for bringing the right attitude about wanting to be great, to his job each week.
And it could also have been a message to the locker room in general, too. So,
that's true, yeah. Yeah. And that's where I think KO is a good spokesperson for the Paul Levesque era, if Paul Levesque wants someone to be the vocal embodiment of what's different without it seeming like he's throwing it in his father-in-law's face.
And I really can't shake the feeling that this was an actual response to the Moxley promo that Kevin. If they get like into cross brand, just let's see who gets the best most fired up promo. That might be some fun stuff ahead.
I liked Moxley's better than Kevin Owens. I would have it in a higher category, but get you liking them both as much as you are.
Yeah.
And maybe it was the context of the moment where, AEW needed a leader that week. They needed someone to step up and say, I'm here. And, he had almost primed the pump the week before going, I'm in my prime and I'm ready to go. And I mean, Moxley is hard to read, and I don't want to get on the AEW tangent here. And maybe he just has all the respect in the world and adores CM Punk. But man, some of the stuff he said on TV makes it seem like Moxley has a chip on his shoulder about the Punk signing, and kind of looking around, going, "Well, I'm here, and I've got a better attitude. I'm better in the locker room, and I'm more durable, and my matches are better, and my promos are better." Don't let the shiny new toy, Tony, or your nostalgia blind you to how good I am. And I feel like the content of his promos is trying to send that message. And I think he's fired up for it. And I think that's part of, like, Kevin Owens, I think, already just sort of has that endorsement. And this is more of an I told you so to Vince, or a reflection of him getting an endorsement from the new boss, where Moxley almost seems like he's just trying to get the attention of his boss, saying, have you figured it out yet, Tony? I'm your guy. And Kevin Owens' message seems to be, hey, everybody, I'm the type of guy who's going to get featured better now because of Levesque. Like, he's already in that spot. And obviously Moxley is to a degree, but there's, with Tony, there's sort of you're on his radar for 3 weeks, but then you might not be, if something else comes along.
Yeah. And the Moxley one may be like, gung ho for the company, while the Kevin Owens one had me looking up wrestling schools in my area. because he made me more love wrestling. The Moxley one I did like better because of the importance. And I mean, like, he started, like, you could see him get emotional at one point where he had to, like, regain himself because he really wanted what he was. But between those two, I mean, that's hopefully this elevates everybody's game across both companies. So
I think so far I think so far it has.
Yeah.
I get the sense the in-ring product in WWE isn't the good workers are inspired to send a message to fans, we're working hard and we're talented and we're going to combine the best of WWE style and some of the discipline and storytelting and economy of moves. We're going to apply that, but add work ethic and the competitiveness and a forward leaning athleticism into the mix that Vince didn't emphasize and try to compare favorably to what AEW is touted for being best at.
And I think we've gotten, like, every week at least one "this is awesome" chant. Not that that's the end all be all, but Tom, how would you feel if all those NXT chants come back, and any ones you don't want?
Well, I you mentioned "this is awesome," and my immediate thought was, man, if I was a wrestler, I would kind of resent it if I was getting a "this is awesome" chant, because it just, we're acknowledging that what you're doing is not genuine, but it's entertaining though. And I don't like the fourth wall chant. And yes, the Full Sail crowd became quite obnoxious, but I don't know. Like, when they go back to Kansas City, I'm not expecting that they'll be a larger version of the Full Sail crowd. Full Sail crowd got the way it did because it's the same people every single week who start to feel entitled and start to have their own inside jokes and start to try to get themselves over.
And who know the mic will pick up what they're saying.
Yeah, yes.
I
learned, the very first show I went to, I decided to get cocky and shout something. And then when I watched it back on TV, I could hear myself. And I was just like, well, I'm not going to do that again.
The one thing I read, the other awesome thing about that segment is that they're obviously building something up with between Theory and Gargano, but first we're doing something with Kevin Owens. You had Balor mixing things up with Riddle, so you're basically filling up the time with fresh ideas and fresh matchups, even though they're not going to play up like Balor and Riddle probably is not going to, you're not going to revisit that for now because obviously you're going back to Seth and Riddle. But after that, you know, now Riddle has, you're building history for, you know, Riddle maybe being going up against Judgment Day next, that sort of thing, which keeps things excited and not bland. Because, I mean, we already talked about how WWE, you know, under Levesque has gotten rid of the annoyances, but it's also, you know, stirring the pot and, you know, off enough where things start, feel fresher.
Yeah. What else have you?
I totally agree with the Bailey thing. you can put me on the same boat as that. I mean, it's exciting that they came back, but it's kind of been the same thing over and over again, which is in contrast to now with because this is the most impressed I've been with Judgment Day. Because that's the other thing. Like I was originally going to come in, and because I've actually Dominic. Turn on Clash of the Castle, the story started picking up, particularly that's, you know, how he turned and how he, you know, the body language with, you know, Ray, you know, celebrating with Edge and like not moving to his son. And I was literally watching the TV, yelling at the TV, you know, Ray, go hug your son, Ray, Ray, your son needs you. Go hug your son. So, you know, by the time that you know, Dominic took his head off, I cheered. You know, you could ask my brother, I cheered for that because I'm like, you know, Ray, I mean, you're blind to this. And the thing is, they've told this is a long-going gestating story, you know, because you've mentioned it before, is like Ray the bad guy, because there were moments where he was like the overbearing father. And there were questions, is it going to be Ray who's going to be the bad guy, that sort of thing. So this has been going on for a bit. And it makes sense that, you know, he shaped so much under it. Then all of a sudden, you know, Dad's old war buddy comes by. So he starts spending time with his war buddy instead of him when he needs them. And it kind of makes total sense why, you know, Ray would, why Dominic would, you know, push Ray away. And then you have like this gang with this, you know, girl and joining them. It was really interesting. I was worried that they wouldn't have the chops to pull it off, but you know, Dominic was fine because Dominic is, you know, he is playing the naive, I don't know what I'm doing kind of guy. So being a green, I don't know what I'm doing kind of guy kind of, you know, works into it. I was worried about Ray and the Judgment Day, but the Judgment Day kind of did feel threatening there at the end. It only took them nearly ending Edge's career for like the eighth time now for it to happen, to finally click. But I've liked it so far. I think it was weird because it almost felt like what AEW was trying to do with the Dark Order when, you know, that debacle happened. But this one felt like it actually hit while that other one didn't.
Tom, any thoughts on what Javier just said?
Yeah, no, I'll reiterate that I like that the storyline is complex enough and the characters are in interesting enough positions that I can't figure out where it's going. It could go to Ray versus Dominic in a one-on-one match. It could go to some sort of team thing, you know, the Judgment Day versus a collection of faces. It could go to Ray versus Edge. And maybe neither of them has to turn heel for that to happen. But I'm very intrigued to see whatever the next development is. I'm kind of hoping that Edge doesn't just disappear from TV for an extended until the Royal Rumble. You know, it seems like they've been trying to write him out, but he's such an interesting element in the mix here that I even if it's not in a wrestling context, I would like for him to still remain a character on the show. But
Very good. Javier, anything else?
Do you think that the Aaliyah, Raquel Rodriguez, them dropping the titles, do you think that's a pivot? Because it just feels kind of weird that it was so soon that they dropped the titles to Shirai and or sorry, not Shirai, Io Sky and
I feel like Gonzalez and Aaliyah won just, or Rodriguez and Aaliyah won just to set up a TV match in front of a large audience with Sky and Kai winning. I think I said that at the time. It just felt like a temporary thing so they could just buy some time, get another. I mean, I think when you book pay-per-view finishes, you shouldn't be going, hey, should I book a different finish on a PLE so that I can then feature another version of it on TV? But it's not the dumbest thing to do if you're a booker to keep in mind, you know, do I want to just do a straight up rematch where the baby faces lose twice, and how do they earn a rematch if they lose? So to me, this just sort of was a way for him to kind of still fill in a little bit of time before getting to Bliss and Asuka as the challengers. But you know, you could watch what Gonzalez and Ali were doing and be like, yeah, they're not really ready to go with. And you could maybe imagine he decided to pull the rug, out from under them in their title reign a little quicker, to end it a little quicker than was the plan. But I would have thought, regardless of how, you know, chemistry issues, which was just kind of weird and clunky in-ring work, you know, being pretty prominent, I still would have thought they would have gone with this timetable. Tom, what do you think?
Yeah, it was a rough match tonight. I felt the same as you did when they won the titles. I agree with your assessment of why they won. I think a lot of us were thinking that tonight would be the night that Sasha and Naomi would come back, and you know, wherever that stands, I was almost glad that they didn't. I mean, I was waiting for it, but I was almost glad it didn't happen. Just because, like, what one thing I do question, like, oh, it's exciting that we're getting all these returns right now, and you guys are talking about sending messages, and I feel like that is, whether it's to wrestlers, whether it's to fans, of course it's to, you know, to everybody, that is the key behind why Levesque has decided to do all these returns in such rapid succession. But it also leaves me feeling like, as much as I'm enjoying most of them, this side of Braun Strowman and Karrion Kross, you know, why can't you just do one a month or one every season and really focus on it and make it a bigger deal? And so if they are going to prolong this one and milk it out, I feel safely assuming we are going to get it, but assuming we're going to get it, then yeah, go for it. Don't just bring them back because you hammered out their contract and you can.
Javier, anything else?
Well, it was funny because USA's Twitter actually promoted WWE by saying, you know, picture of some of the people who've returned, and it says, who's next? And you know, no one returned today.
Wow.
So I was just kind of, you know, unless you count almost, but I don't know. I think that's pretty much all I had. It was a good show. I enjoyed it, and I watched it live. I didn't have to, you know, which is normally a drag, because normally I just fast, you know, I give it an hour and then fast forward to commercials. But I watched it live and didn't drag it being 3 hours. So.
Nice.
Yeah, so
thanks, Javier. Always good talking to you. Yeah, appreciate it.
Right, have a good night, guys.
Tom, how? Yeah, you too. Tom, how is Raw doing for you as far in the Levesque era in terms of just being an easier watch or a more engaging watch, big picture, now that we're, you know, 3 more weeks into it since we last talked?
Big picture, I just boil it down to how much I am looking forward to it, how much without being in the co-host chair or without thinking about, you know, any PW Torch analysis or anything like that, just how much do I remember, oh, hey, it's Monday, I want to turn the show on at 8 p.m. And very recently, it's been like, okay, I'll keep up with it because I'll get the co-host call and I will watch that show because I'm going to be on the podcast, but it feels like more of a chore. Whereas now, I genuinely want to watch every week. Like the past 2 weeks, I specifically tuned in because I wanted to see what they were going to do with Johnny Gargano. And I think both weeks they had him do something in the third hour. So, I mean, it kept me there. I wanted to see when Gargano was going to show up. And, you know, I'm tuning in on SmackDown to see what's going on with the Bloodline, to see, you know, whatever else, you know, what's going on with Gunther and Sheamus and all that. I am genuinely interested right now. Like if I wasn't co-hosting with you, I would still be watching. So I just simply boil it down to that.
Yeah, I can imagine. I would think that there'd be a high percentage of people who would just say, I was watching Raw out of a sense of just, it's something I've always done. But I had mixed feelings about whether it was the best choice for my life. And mm-hmm. I think now it would shift to, I am actually waking up and spending my day thinking, checking WWE.com or PWTorch.com, find out what's going to be on the show and looking forward to it and thinking about it and anticipating it with a much higher percentage of positive vibes. And that's something you can build on over time to a greater level of success. It's not hot-shotting. I mean, he's done his fair share of hot-shotting, for sure, in terms of, I don't know if hot-shotting's work, because that is a negative connotation, but, you know, trying to make some impact moves to you know, create buzz and get on the radar, people's radar. But there's been a discipline to the booking that just sort of says, I think doing it this way is going to ultimately lead to more people watching more often and fewer people peeling off over time out of frustration.
Yeah, yeah, that's the checking the news and stuff like that is a good barometer as well. Now that you mention it, I have found myself just refreshing PWTorch.com more often than usual, just because I'm genuinely curious what's recently been, you know, hit the headlines. So that is, yeah, that's definitely been increased as well.
And by the way, I have tabs open for the free version of PW Torch and the ad-free VIP version. And I'll tell everybody, it's a nice perk of being a VIP member, even though I get a free subscription. You know, I allow myself that. I give myself that. But it's really nice being able to hit refresh and just having that clean ad-free layout. So I don't tout that as much. I tout the podcast and the back issues. But the ad-free website, the ad-free version of the website, it's really nice. It just loads so fast and looks so clean. And there's, you know, a lot of bonus content, too, in terms of our articles. Anyway, so pwtorch.com/govip. You can look at our sign-up options and enjoy the ad-free experience, not just with podcasts, but also with our website. All right, well, we'll wrap up with a couple emails to bring up some things we haven't really covered, and then we'll sign up because we're running long. We're not running longer than usual. We always run long. There's always so much to talk about and so many good calls and good talking points. JB from Detroit says, I am continually happy with the elevation of the U.S. title. His subject line was continued elevation of secondary titles, by the way. Lashley Rollins will be fun next week, and it's exactly what I want to see, with Roman being a rare occasion on TV, especially Raw. With that being said, I think they need to at least acknowledge that the true goal of the United States title, that should be the ultimate target for every male wrestler on both shows. In Lashley's backstage promo, he made it seem as though because he was holding the U.S. goal that he was the face of Raw, when in reality it should be Roman. I'm okay with elevating the U.S. title and making it a central factor on Raw, but if they made the decision to roll with a unified title, they have to have to own that narrative as well. Wade's mentioned it before, but the fact that Roman isn't in the opening montage for Raw is telling in where they stand with how they want things presented. As always, love the show and go VIP. So we haven't talked about that segment where Seth has been saying, I want to be, it's been too long since I'm champion. It's his way of sort of trying to shift away from a rematch with Riddle, going, I got my other things, I'm done with you. So it serves that purpose. It also is planting the seed for an eventual Seth-Roman match or a Seth versus whoever is champion at that time match. But in this case, it also worked to setting up Bobby Lashley going, I hear you're talking about wanting gold. How'd you feel about that segment? And in particular, but not only, but in particular, Seth going, well, that's not the goal that's not the championship I was referring to. Because it does undercut part of what JB is advocating for, which is make the U.S. title the centerpiece. Everyone should talk about it. That's the main title. That's full-time on Raw. Do you really want Seth, a full-time Raw guy, saying on the cusp of getting a title shot, well, that's not the title I was talking about. I would have edited that off, even if it's sort of implied by them and assumed by fans to be true. Tom, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that line could have been edited. I mean, even with Seth being a heel, you look at how John Cena treated the United States Championship, and it worked. You know, even though he's as top a guy as you're going to get, he still valued chasing the U.S. championship and defending it. And it made sense and was one of the more revered periods of Cena's career. So yeah, I'm all for you know, raising the value of the U.S. title. I like the way Lashley is talking about himself, you know, in that segment because he's the U.S. champion. I even, you know, yes, they should take the excuse of Roman being the WWE champion to put him in the opening because he's the biggest star in the company. So go ahead and do that. But I absolutely let Roman get away with just showing up every once in a while on SmackDown because of what I mentioned before and what I mention all the time. You know, he's staying special. It's a massive deal when he shows up, even just to cut a short promo and say, acknowledge me. So it feels momentous when he shows up, no matter what he does. So keep it that way. He shouldn't have to, he shouldn't be showing up. I'm happy with Roman's schedule as it is. But yeah, in the meantime, absolutely make the United States championship a bigger deal on Raw. So seems a bit out of nowhere that we're going to get Rollins versus Lashley, but it also kind of feels like, well, why not? I mean, on one hand, one of the things that I thought was a benefit to Sonya being the one to answer BB's challenge, it's just like, all right, well, you're not burning. Like, it sort of qualifies as a surprise. I mean, okay. But you're not burning an opponent who you could do a longer-term significant storyline with Bianca. So all right. And you could do that with Seth and Lashley, but, you know, just having them, you know, feeling on different paths right now, crossing over for a match that they can spend a week promoting, to the extent that they do, it feels like, why not? Okay, sure. And then what I worry about is just that it's going to be, you know, Seth was talking about karma, and, you know, Riddle's going to come out and be like, well, here's some karma, bro, and that'll just be how the segment ends, is that Riddle spoils the match. You know, I worry about that it's just going to be an echo of what we saw this week. I would not have put Balor over Riddle. I would have had Riddle win the match and then Seth attack afterward. And Seth, tangentially, Seth absolutely needed to. I would have had him do, I mean, I don't know. I guess it would be redundant because he's pretty viciously attacked Riddle very recently. But he at least needed to do what he did in that post-match in stomping Riddle, because he came off like a popular babyface opening the show and everybody singing his song and cheering him. I mean, he had the crowd in the palm of his hand, and I was like, this guy's got to do something mean before this show goes off the air, because he's playing too much into
Do you think Seth and Roman, when they face off, is going to be Roman heel, Seth face, both as heels? Or Seth as a face, and or whatever, the reverse of what I said first. Who's going to be the heel?
I would – oh, boy, yeah, it depends on the timeline, because Roman definitely has a monster face run that we have yet to see. And Seth maybe has another shot at a face run under Levesque that could go differently than when they tried it.
Because of the damn spot.
Yeah. And I think, you know, people are enjoying how goofy he is now and everything, even though I also agree with your analysis of why he's doing it, because maybe other things weren't clicking. So now he's just sort of accentuating, you know, what himself, his behavior, and just trying to find whatever character lies therein. But even though those seem like eventualities that could absolutely work, again, maybe it's a cop-out answer. I think anything works, because at least I heard out the criticisms as well. But I absolutely loved Roman and Rollins's heel championship match at the Royal Rumble. I thought that it was just brilliantly executed, and I was so invested in it. And that's the reason that match and how it the entire story of the match. Is why when Rollins says that he wants to get back to the Universal Championship, it means something to me rather than just sort of like a talking point that he's trying to squeeze in, because of the story that he told in that match against Roman and the sympathy that they got that he mounted there, and the believability that he feels like he is a threat to Roman, and to be fair, a lot of people do, and I feel like they've been throughout Roman's run, they've been playing with fire in making him seem too vulnerable until the Usos run in. I think, like, when Roman's wrestling someone like a Finn Balor, he should just beat Balor clean rather than the weirdness of the rope breaking or whatever that was. You should have more people that Roman is beating clean rather than relying on interference. It means more to me when Rollins mentions that he wants that championship back because of the story he has proven he can tell with, regardless of alignment.
Two quick emails to wrap up. Zach in Texas said Raw continues to be steady. Not great, but not insulting or painful to watch either. My complaints are mostly about some of the questionable booking choices Hunter's made. Firstly, what's the point of having Aaliyah pin Dakota Kai if the titles are just going to change hands 2 weeks later? We kind of talked about that. I mean, there's pros and cons, obviously. That was insulting to Dakota and unnecessary. Damage Control should have won the titles in the first place. My biggest concern, though, is Dominic Mysterio. If Dom is in your main event, there's a serious problem. Given his complete dearth of talent, Dom should be nowhere near the most important match on the show. There's just no good reason to taint that spot with somebody who struggles due to the most basic of maneuvers. So we started the show, Tom, and I think we both agreed Dom was at the threshold of acceptability based on the strength of the storyline and the family legacy that's built into it. If Dominic wasn't Rey's son, of course he's not in the main event. But he is Rey's son, and this is a backstory they built. And Edge has been part of that story. This wasn't thrown together. It wasn't a main event out of desperation. It was a main event because it makes sense. I would push back to Zach's take. It makes sense to main event with it. It's Edge in a singles match on Raw against anyone should be a main event on Raw at this point with his stature and what he's done. And there's a backstory with Dominic and the Rhea Ripley and Judgment Day aspect. And then you've got Rey as the dad and Edge as a longtime family friend who would stay with them when he visited San Diego. There's absolutely enough going on to justify it's the main event. And I don't watch Dominic going, he's struggling to do basic moves. He's not, like, I felt like with Aaliyah and Rodriguez, it felt like they were walking through a match while a coach was yelling at them, yeah, now lean over and hold that spot while this opponent runs the ropes and is about to kick you. Like, they were leaning into spots, and you could see them thinking, almost like you could almost see them thinking about what they're going to do next, as opposed to just being in the flow. And I don't really sense that with Dominic. I mean, he's not polished in top tier, but I don't think he's an embarrassment out there, Tom, at all.
Yeah. This is definitely a Zach email. Yeah. No, Dom has been suitable. He's not distractingly poor, for the position, that he's in, even though he hasn't excited me or even, remotely interested me until the heel turn. And even the heel turn itself was mostly because of the vociferous Cardiff reaction to it. And, you know, the middle fingers that he was getting walking out and everything. But yeah, tonight it was all about storytelling, and, you know, most of the match was him just, Edge just wiping the mat with him. So he wasn't being relied upon to do much more than, like, I think the most impressive thing that he did physically in the match was probably, like, do the shoulder going into the ring post thing. He wasn't called upon to be doing moves in this match, but he absolutely lived up to what he was called to do and tell his part of the story. And I was by far more engaged by Dominic here than I ever have been. And like I said, like, I worry I never will be again, because I'm not sure if he will ever have a coalescence of significance and storytelling and everything as significant as this. I felt like this was absolutely the rightful main event when you look at the rest of the card, which, sure, depending on how you look at it, could play into Zach's point. But this was totally earned for me. Yeah.
Javier says, and he brings something up, we have not.
I know what it is.
Dexter
yes,
Loomis.
That's it.
Javier says, Graves losing his mind over how nonchalant everyone is over Dexter Loomis's crimes. It's my biggest guilty pleasure right now. Dexter just showing up in Miz's house. By the way, what was it called? The manor of
Mar-Miz? I don't watch the reality show. I'm guessing that was established there.
The Manor of Marmiz. Let me look up Marmiz on my report here. Yeah, Manor Marmiz. They have the signage up. I mean, their house is just so, like, opulently over the top, and I couldn't possibly feel comfortable in their house. There's not a moment they can't be self-aware of how gaudy their design is. It's like a museum or a hotel lobby to each their own in terms of their style. But, my God, you know, like the harp and the piano. And I know I don't know that they're playing it up for TV in the reality show, or that's just what Maurice wants or Miz wants with the money that they have. And like I said, everybody can indulge, you know, when they succeed to the degree that Miz and Maurice have financially. But man, it would be hard to be a babyface and not forget that's where Miz and Maurice live, and they call it Manor Marmiz. So anyway, that sidebar aside, are you getting a kick out of Dexter Lumis? And like I threw a fit over a match with tag team contendership at stake being destroyed by babyface Braun, and the announcers don't seem to care that there's all this fighting going on, and well, it doesn't even count. Who cares? It just matters that Braun's back. That bothers me. Bothers me that Karrion Kross ends a hard-fought match by attacking Drew, and it's just like, well, the story is what happened with Kross, as opposed to we had a good match going here, and it just got ruined. You know, like I don't want a tie game in a football game with a field goal about to be kicked, and then somebody runs on the field, and they just go, well, the football game's off. Who cares? Let's just talk about the run-in. Like, and I know it's WWE, and there's latitude. To me, the latitude comes with a Dexter Lumis storyline, not titles and not main events. And I think it's fun. Like, people think I just want a pure sports-like presentation. No, I don't. I just want the titles protected, and I want main event outcomes more often than they are to have a brave booked finish, not, you know, the escape hatch. So all that said, I too am getting a kick out of Dexter Lumis. And now they've introduced him as an artist. I don't know if they had done that on Raw yet. So Tom, what'd you think about this week's chapter and his tormenting Miz, in general?
Yeah, I don't think they had introduced his caricature art yet, which was something I was hoping.
Tom, I'm sorry, I'm interrupting again. On today's Wade Keller Pro Wrestling podcast, we have my interview from 30 years ago with Jerry Lawler, after a conversation that Bruce Mitchell and I had with Randy Hales, which is great. Randy is fantastic, just telling great stories from Memphis. He worked behind the scenes and on camera in Memphis for so many years. But then my 30 years ago interview with Jerry Lawler, talking about how he became a wrestler because he submitted art. He drew wrestlers, and then he got pulled in to do more, and then that led to him becoming a wrestler. So I point people towards that. It's an interview classic selection today that went up earlier tonight, and it's absolutely worth listening. Just a clinic and graduate level course on territorial wrestling with a focus on Memphis. Jerry Lawler talks about David Letterman and Andy Kaufman. And it's some cool stuff. I had to sneak that in, Tom, because if I forgot and then we ended the show, I'd feel bad. So I risked interrupting you to tell that story.
I'm glad you did. I have a high level of respect for Jerry Lawler, so I will definitely be listening to that. And I was aware of that factoid about him. I believe he also is a caricature artist like Dexter Lumis.
Yeah.
So I believe that is the specific style he specializes in, although I believe he's also branched out over the years. I don't know, perhaps. I will absolutely be putting that on during my commute. I was hoping that they wouldn't bring that into the Lumis character on the main roster because it never worked for me on NXT. There was so much about Dexter Lumis that did not work for me on NXT, even though he did get to a point where I started to enjoy him as part of the Indy Hartwell storyline. And what a wonderful coda that finally got, but the art element of it just never made sense. It just sort of felt like he can do this, but should he? Just because he can doesn't mean you have to put it on TV. It didn't seem to gel, but here we are. Even though I have had the nitpick of say like when Lumis dragged Miz through the crowd, the way that they did it, you inevitably get the backdrop of people smiling and laughing at a person being choked out and kidnapped. So even though Loomis's whole thing is that he's like a serial kidnapper and, you know, whatever he is creepy and everything, it's still lighthearted to an extent. So they are trying to toe that line, but I still don't know if you want like people laughing right next to somebody being kidnapped, even if it is the Miz and if he is a heel. So I've had nitpicks like that. And unfortunately tonight, man, I really wanted to like this because I liked the opening moment of like we're seeing through the camera crew's camera that, you know, the interview camera crew that's come in to do a little piece on The Miz. And the camera pans over to look at the piano and you catch Loomis in the window and it goes back and you're sort of wondering, did anybody else see that? Does anybody know that he's there? And then just totally innocently, The Miz's children go in and interrupt and they're messing with the piano. And so when the camera just naturally goes back over to see what they're doing, Loomis just isn't there anymore. And it was a very nice little touch and didn't feel overly orchestrated, but we got to, overall, we got to a point, especially with the camera crew lingering after The Miz drove away, and training the camera back on the window where Loomis was inside the house, it felt like, okay, well, I guess the camera crew was in on it because they knew to try to find Loomis after the fact and they weren't doing anything about it. So that felt weird. But even more than that, you've got The Miz, who with the exception of the, like, I think 9 years ago now, face turn to be U.S. champion, and I guess the genuine excitement that many of us had when he showed the real emotion against Daniel Bryan on that Talking Smack episode. Just a consistent heel, just dedicated himself to being just this smarmy, despicable person on TV. He leans into it. We're seeing him dressed up nice with his beautiful wife and his beautiful home and just, you know, gaudy, all the way you described it. And yet, and he's, you know, he's having this this piece done about how wonderful his home is. And there were even a couple things that he said in the segment where it's just like, man, this guy's so stuck up and superficial and everything. But even still, this is a person in their home with their children, with their family, who is leaving the house. And I can't remember whether the children got in the car with him or not, or whether we're supposed to believe there was a babysitter or something. I'm not sure, but I was genuinely creeped out. So I guess success, I was genuinely creeped out by Loomis being there. But even my point is, even with all of that heelness heaped upon The Miz, I still looked at The Miz as like the sympathetic, you know, character. And I was like, oh no, Miz, the killer's outside the window, run away. I don't want, you know, bad things to befall you. And I didn't find it like amusing that Loomis was creeping and then getting inside his family's home. So that I've used the term playing with fire already. I don't even know if that's what it is. Like they've just like jumped right into the fire on this one. And I know that Loomis is still the baby face and that next week they'll probably do something that I'll be like, oh, you won me back. And I'm amused by this again. But yeah, this week it just didn't work for me. And the characterization was all off.
All right. Tom, thank you. Anything you want to mention such as Twitter or otherwise?
No, I'll just point people toward Bonus Point again. I think it may be a show that doesn't get clicked on much because people are like, oh, well, it's about that NXT Level Up preliminary show with wrestlers I've never heard of before. I don't watch that, so I'm not going to listen to that. Well, the podcast is designed so you don't have to watch that show. For example, Sol Ruka is going to debut tomorrow night on NXT. For the past 2 months, I've been talking about Sol Ruka, so if you've been listening to Bonus Point, you've got a leg up and you already know, you know, how I've been analyzing her matches and what I think her early potential is. So that is the purpose of the podcast, to give you your little bonus point so you can be ahead of the curve. So check that out on PW Torch VIP.
Tom, thank you so much. Always great having you on.
Likewise, Wade. Thank you.
You bet. Thanks, everybody, and we'll talk to you all next time.